Alright, so organizing and defending faith, I'm basically just going to go as far as I can. I think as far as that, I was going to do the third session this week was going to get into Ebionism and Gnosticism. Gnosticism is such a vast topic, I'm just going to blend Ebionism into this one at the end. So you'll notice that in your notes. I'm just going to overlap a little bit and go into Ebionism at the tail end. Unless we don't have time, unless I'm underestimating the amount of time all the stuff on apologetics is going to take here. But in case you haven't noticed already, there is a battle over orthodoxy. If you watch the Hitler channel during Easter time, you will notice that there is a battle going on for the way things happen. I'm going to put above this line, representing in eternity, the essence of orthodoxy, and below, the expression of orthodoxy. And I'll put it in the plural. There's nothing whatsoever wrong with listing pragmatic reasons or sociological reasons that the church defended this doctrine or stated clearly this doctrine. For example, there's a book written in, I think, 2006 by Alistair McGrath called Heresy. And he does a good job explaining all the early heresies and explaining why the church did what they did. And so he stands against the liberal thesis at the extremes that you will get on those channels that basically just repeat what's often said about history. History is written by its winners. Well, this, all it's saying is this, a species of the same thing, that orthodox history or the formulation of orthodoxy is written by its winners. It's very cynical, obviously, very conspiratorial, usually giving us a sob story of why the Gnostics weren't invited to the party, stuff like that. And so if you counter that, oftentimes it's very tempting to say, no, the church had to define who it is for its own identity so that it can survive, so that it can withstand persecution, so it can teach people and not, in other words, to protect its own identity, to survive as a movement. Now, that's all true. I absolutely accept that. The church was motivated by those things. But if you start your definition of orthodoxy there, then you've reduced eternal truth to a sociological phenomenon, an evolutionary phenomenon. And that quote by Shelley that Josh wrote is unwittingly picking up that airborne virus. And you see that in the church, and you see it in Alistair McGrath's book. In fact, both Alistair McGrath and a British historian, Paul Johnson, whose book History of Christianity, the first one I ever read, talks like that. And so it's very evolutionary that now they'll defend the thing that became orthodoxy. So they'll say that what these liberals call proto-orthodoxy was the rightful, not heir, but what became the Catholic Church was the rightful heir of the orthodox teaching. But if you ask them, does what makes this orthodoxy, is it that it lines up with the teaching of Scripture? They will refer to that as naive every bit as much as a liberal will. This is the kind of stuff that is read at the seminary level in all the textbooks. Because you're just opening up a book on church history and taking it at their word that they are just teaching history, when in fact they are smuggling in a lot of philosophy. By the way, sorry, random thought. Last week I said the word cited. I was listening to the thing yesterday. I was like, oh, good, thank you. You remember that. That's disturbing. Sometimes my mouth gets moving, and I had given up coffee. I got my coffee today, so I won't make that mistake. I was like, I don't even know what the context was. I just remembered it. Fight it. I was screaming at myself for a while. My wife's laughing at me. And like, well, maybe they didn't pick up on it. It's like, no, they...
We did.
I'm pretty sure they did. Fight it. Yeah. It's Old English for fight it. That's right. All right, well, this is about the church having fighted for orthodoxy, organizing and defending the faith. But this is what's happening. Ultimately, in these kind of statements, what you're doing is you're reducing the truth, the essence of the truth, to the expressions of the truth. There is a truth in saying that orthodoxy is constructed in reaction for practical measures, for survival, for defining things, setting up fences, protecting people. But as to whether or not that construction is true about what God has said, the sociological comparisons are of little use and they are often of great mischief. There's another chart that I would draw up there right from the beginning. You're going to start to see, I don't have a map today yet, but the only map I'm really going to have, and you'll see it in your notes if you print those out, is I'm just going to write, just to give you the landscape of what's happening here, I'll put Carthage, by the way, again, Mediterranean Sea. Little waves. Carthage, Alexandria, all both on the north coast of Africa. Jerusalem's over here, and Athens over here. So there's the sea. Look at that. Look at that Italy. Fast, on the fly. What you're going to see is a development already, a development in the turn of the second century to these epicenters of Christendom, one of them being the Latin West, and I'll just put Latin. One of them developing in Alexandria, which I will just call Greek. And then this sort of undifferentiated, already existing, and the emerging church would tell us the only pure form, well, which we'll just call Eastern for now, because it was already there. But intellectually, these two epicenters of Christendom are already getting underway. Long before there was a split between East and West, meaning Eastern Orthodoxy and the Roman Catholic Church, there was first a theological division between Greek and Latin. In a sense, this would become the later split. But if we draw the lines that neatly, it's going to come with some pretty inconvenient ironies for the emerging thesis of our day. The Greek philosophical theologians of Alexandria tended to be more imaginative in their inferences. So what's going to separate the Greek and the Latin is not that one thinks and the other doesn't. They're both defined by their thinkers. Okay, that's going to be important. But the Greeks are more into philosophical speculation in Alexandria, the Alexandrian school. The Latin systematizers of Europe, and they tend to be more pastors, like Irenaeus of Lyons, and you already saw Clement. They were motivated by pastoral concerns. Not that the other guys weren't, but they were really just copying, handing down the rule of faith, so to speak. This division was then divided again from the faith of the Near East, in which truth was sought in community and practice more than reflection first. The Eastern faith would eventually be a patchwork of the African Greek imagination and the Near Eastern communalism. So in other words, when you eventually do get the Eastern Orthodox Church, it's going to be a patchwork of this speculating tendency with this communal tendency. And then the philosophical foundations of these guys and the pastoral systematizing of the rule of faith is going to create, well, Rome. Latin Christendom. Okay, so if you pay careful attention to the ideas at the foundation of these theological traditions, you'll start to see a little bit, it wasn't just this political intrigue that separated East and West. There was a philosophical difference, and you'll see those same things come up in the Protestant Reformation and in other various strands. But here's the point. What's going on here is different aspects of the Christian faith are being pit against other legitimate aspects of the Christian faith. So the spirit and truth together, John 4:24, or the way, truth, and the life together, John 14:6, the holistic Christianity of Jesus was already being institutionally fractured, just as a so-called accidents of history. So in other words, humans are in charge now. And this is the point when you would most want to say, aha, it's exactly what I was expecting from church history. The first three centuries, the room empties, and we don't know what happened. If that's what you're taking from what I'm saying, rewind. That's not what happened. We do know what happened in the first three centuries. We do have a lot of writings, as Jamie mentioned, that are gone. On the other hand, we do have a very clear paper trail, and a lot of these books that are gone, by the way, are quoted verbatim by the hundreds and thousands of quotes in people like Eusebius and Irenaeus and others. So we do know exactly what happened in the first three centuries. Okay, but what we do see is a human pitting one thing against another in a way that you can see it. For example, the argument that Constantine reinvented the faith, or that all these different cults in the modern world that have to reinvent the faith, restore the office, they'll say things like, well, the texts of the first three centuries are corrupt. My question, corrupt in comparison to what? What are you judging them against if we've lost all the manuscripts in the first three centuries? Know your philosophy. It'll be easy to destroy stupid arguments in 30 seconds or less when you just get a little bit of logic. These texts don't measure up to what? If we don't have any of them, to what are you comparing them? Okay? The argument doesn't work. Now, the East and West was also dividing on less serious issues. For example, when do you celebrate Easter? So, for example, Polycarp was brought to Rome sometime around in the 150s to meet with its bishop, and this was the third bishop, if you accept Rome, the second one, I spelt it wrong, that's not the name. I'm sorry, I'm thinking about the first century. This is a different guy in the second century whose name I did spell right. It's not the same guy. Anacletus was the guy in the first century. But right around the 150s, Polycarp goes to Rome to meet with him. And there's a disagreement about where to or when to celebrate Easter. So, for example, the churches in Asia Minor, where Polycarp was from, they were celebrating it on the Jewish Passover, where all the, in the West already, they were so attending to details and stuff like that. That's what makes us the impressive imperialists that we will become, is they insisted on celebrating it on Sunday. Okay. And by the way, one of the things you're going to see right away in the first century, in the first and the second century, as you go into the second century, is all of the doctrines that were taught throughout the Reformation time and on were taught from the beginning and are always talked about. For example, in Clement's letter, the Trinity is mentioned dozens of times. This was not a later concoction. Sunday worship is mentioned, by Clement in that letter. So in the last decade of the first century, they are worshiping on Sunday. Now, you can say that they're wrong, but you can't say it was an invention of Constantine in the 320s. It doesn't work, because they were already doing it. So, just a couple of examples of how those oppressive imperialists that created Christianity in a dark, smoke-filled room actually know it was already there in the second century. It doesn't work. So, what we're going to look at is the apologists to Rome, and if we get into Ebionism, we will do that. And then later in tomorrow, I'll get into Gnosticism and the defense of orthodoxy and its critics. But here's my big idea for this whole thing, for my three sessions. The story of the development of orthodoxy dares us to love truth in the teeth of the mixed bag of sin and sincerity that all history presents. Now, if you have your notes, that's on the very top center. I always put my big idea there. So let me just read it again. The story of the development of orthodoxy dares us to love truth in the teeth of the mixed bag of sin and sincerity that all history presents. The sin and error of the early church is not a unique thing. We criticize them as hypocrites and very forgetful ones when we do. You can't find an era of history where there was this rosy, ideal setting where everybody got everything right. Well, if the early church would have just done things more like who are you thinking of right now? Me and my friends? Alright? There was no such time. So if you just remember that and look at the record for what it's worth, the only question for you is going to be, do you understand orthodoxy, straight teaching, truth, as something that transcends how the church expressed it, and can you get at that? Can you know that? And if not, what the heck are you talking about? By what standard do you judge or criticize something down here unless, in other words, you can't call a line crooked unless you have the idea of a straight line. Okay? And so that's the challenge as we study church history, is to love the truth. Any questions before I get underway about these apologists to Rome, the earliest Christian thinkers, apologists? All right. This Greek word, apologia, I'll just write the word apologetics. That's where we get that English word. This is a defense. You remember Socrates' apology before the Athenian council? That's not an apology for who he is. He's not saying he's sorry. It's a legal defense in a legal courtroom setting. And so apologetics is the defense of the Christian faith very literally in the court, because the vast majority of these, especially the ones that were called an apology of Justin Martyr or Hippolytus or whoever, these guys were actually writing to the sitting emperor, saying things like, stop killing Christians, and by the way, Christianity is superior. By the way, it's not going to get the guy off the hook, and it's not going to endear yourself to the person to say, by the way, while we're having this conversation, you're wrong about everything. But they had to make that case because, especially when you had a philosopher emperor like Marcus Aurelius, You had to appeal to reason. They weren't just flattering him. They were criticizing him. Since you are so wise, since you understand philosophy, you will know, for example, how immoral you guys are being versus Christian morality. So actually, it was a very powerful argument. So the apologists to Rome, that's another thing, by the way, to keep in mind before we start. These guys were doing this for their life, writing on the run for their life, defending other people who were going to death for what they believed. They wanted to know what they believed because they wanted to know if what they were going to die for the next day was worth dying for. So the argument that we so often make against all forms of thinking shows itself to be really, really superficial when you look at this era of church history. Now, what do I mean by apologetics besides the defense of the faith? This is often referred, I'm going to add an adjective in here, in this early era as classical apologetics, which often is going to refer to these first guys that I'm going to talk about all the way through Augustine in the 5th century to Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, and you see people still adhere to it in the modern world. Unfortunately, it gets a bad name by people that misunderstand what it is. But classical apologetics is called classical for two reasons. Number one, we call something classical in general when we're speaking of a thing in its original or purest or often even its best expression. Secondly, we call the Christian apologetic of the first couple centuries classical in its philosophical content and methodology. So classical apologetics is distinguished from other forms in that it moves from God or eternal things, that's the metaphysical way to say it, eternal things, the epistemological way to say it is, necessary truths, and deduces or infers from that, I'm going to do the corresponding words, from God to the world, from eternal things to temporal things, or changeable things, and from necessary truths to contingent truths. In other words, from the superior question to the inferior question. From the antecedent truth to the consequent truth. From the thing that ought to be more impressive to us to the thing that ought to be tinker toys by comparison. This is the way that classical thinking worked. Classical thinking, originating in Greek thought and going through the Middle Ages, was closer to human thinking, pre-classical thought, barbarian thought during the medieval era, and then now modern thought is closer to animal thinking. And I can prove it. And we do classes that do that. But at any rate, this is what distinguishes classical thought from less classical thought. You think about things in circles. You put circles around things because you're not just a dog picking bugs and berries like an ignorant savage staring through a telescope and pretending that you're saying something profound by just pointing at dots. You're classifying, you're distinguishing, you're drawing up a hierarchy, you're giving meaning, you're naming things and knowing things as God put Adam in the garden to do, to not be a monkey. So it's distinguishing its content and its methodology. It begins as everything else in the Christian thought scheme does. From the top down, from the invisible to the visible, from God to the world, from first principles to consequent truths, from demonstrations of necessary things to the evidence of contingent things. Let me just give you a couple of examples just to put some flesh on it. If I'm going to argue the resurrection of Christ to you or the authenticity of Scripture, and I find out, during the course of our conversation, that you don't believe in God, what must I do and why? If I want to succeed, if I want to help you. Not if I want to be annoying or something like that. If I want to be of any help to you, what do I do if, in the course of arguing for something evidential, this is probably true based on the convergence of evidence, but I find out that you don't even believe in God, or truth, that words even contain meaning, what do I need to do?
You got to shift. Now,
are you just saying, though, I agree with that, are you just saying that I need to try something else in my bag of tricks randomly, or you use the word essential? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you need to go to the fundamental truth.
Fundamental, foundational, basic. What makes it more basic? Because when I think basic, I think of base, and when I think of base, I think of a house.
Yeah.
What makes what makes those questions that I have to go to more basic than these other questions?
Truths that other truths depend on.
Aha! Truths that other truths depend on. Just like a foundation, just like I can't, typically you don't see people building, putting shingles on structures before they lay the cement, right? Right. So it's the same thing here. If I find out that, now I'll take somebody's word for it. If they say they believe in God, I'll work with them. But then I come to find out that God just means their little inner Shirley MacLaine or something like that. Then I still gotta do the same backtracking because we're comparing apples and oranges. And anybody that's ever talked to a Mormon understands that. You're viewing your scripture. He's got his, you know, Kelly Blue Book over here. And you gotta figure out which, and if something's in the Bible, it's a reason for him not to believe it, because it has to be interpreted by Joseph Smith and stuff like that. So again, you're comparing apples and oranges. But you're not just comparing apples and oranges. You're comparing contingent truths that depend upon more foundational truths. If God doesn't exist, I don't give a rip what the Bible says versus what the Quran said. I'm with the new atheists. But if God does exist, and we're separated from him, then the question of the reliability of Scripture and the resurrection of Christ immediately takes on ultimate connotations. Okay? So classical apologetics is putting first things first. And it's not just a methodological advantage. It's the way things are. Okay? So it just so happens to be more in concert with the reality happened. From God to things outside of God. Okay? So classical apologetics turns out not to just be methodologically superior, but in conforming itself to the way the world is, better than other methodologies, it will wind up teaching Christians about everything better. And you'll be able to think about everything at warp speed, things that would take people normally 30, 40 years, you can wrap up in 6 months. It's exponential learning, because you're thinking about the right thing, looking through the right lenses. The order of the case in classical apologetics flowed from the superiority of monotheistic assumptions to the reality of death and judgment, to the fulfillment of prophecies concerning Christ, to the accompanying signs of miracles, chiefly the resurrection, but also including the proliferation of the church under an unprecedented persecution. You see that in Augustine, but you see it a lot among the early church fathers. And the reason is because they were living through it. They could say to the Roman emperor, who's got who at their in the corner at this point? We're illegal. You guys are feeding us to the lions and we won't stop growing. We're multiplying like gremlins. The more you throw us to the lions, the more we're exploding everywhere. And they could say that quite confidently because it was irrefutable. Now, the Romans had their arguments against Christians. But those deconstructive arguments against the Christian faith were as weak as the dying breaths of Roman civilization itself. When your culture is crumbling around you, it's more difficult to argue for its core when its core is not holding its structure together. Celsus was the chief antagonist of the Christians early on in the second century. He wrote a book called The True Word in 177. Now, he at least admitted of the Christians, their agreement with each other is quite amazing. But, as it turns out, that wasn't really impressive to him because he thought it was a unity of simple-minded ignorance. His argument really is no different than the new atheists of our day. So you just think of that phrase by Richard Dawkins that we obviously, anybody that doesn't believe in evolution is either stupid or wicked. But I'd rather not consider the second possibility. Well, that was pretty much Celsus. So, for example, Celsus writes this. Far from us, say the Christians, be any man possessed of any culture or wisdom or judgment. Their aim is to convince only worthless and contemptible people. Idiots, slaves, poor women, and children. These are the only ones they managed to turn into believers. Now, that was already not true in the first couple centuries. But they did aim, as we've already looked at the lowest of the low, in a sense. And at people, and Paul was arguing before governors and so on. They were writing to philosophers. Luke was writing his book to a wealthy man, two of his books. And so it was not technically true, but it did take something that was true and take it out of its context. Marcus Aurelius, who became the emperor, and he was a Stoic philosopher. He wasn't just a Stoic student. He fancied himself a philosopher, kind of the fulfillment in Rome's mind of the philosopher king that Plato talked about. But he was having to deal with all these Christians and persecuting them. He didn't want to be a menace about it, but at the same time, they wouldn't stop dying for their faith, and they were really annoying. And he was getting all these apologies to him, all these defenses of the faith. The more people he killed, the more apologetics books he kept getting from Christians. And he was really getting annoyed by that. And he distinguished between a heroic sacrificial death and then the sort of suicide as the Christians died in the Colosseum. To him, it was all theatrical. But whose theaters were they, and whose orders were they? And so he's, I would suppose, dealing with a certain amount of hypocrisy on his part that he's dealing with. And, of course, they had to be careful how they argued that, because they would be going to their death next, which did happen. Some of these guys were writing apologies. They did go to their death, and they were caught largely because they wrote these things. But Rome was crumbling, and it becomes difficult to sustain even a majority opinion, even a prevailing opinion, when everything in society built upon that opinion is in rapid and universal decay. Keep that in mind. Let that be a lesson to you. Society right now is in rapid decay, and the people who defend its principles know that it's in decay. They'll blame the wrong things, but understand that they don't believe in foundations because they suspect it doesn't hold up anything. They see something not being held up. So remember, your job there is not to apologize for seeing that. Your job is to drive it into the sea and bury it under the ground and expose their assumptions. As the atheist needs to know that Hitler was his fault. It's not the time to apologize for what we believe when society is crumbling. But such were the conditions of Rome to the observant eye. Now, historians will show that that century, after Domitian stopped his pretty radical persecutions, after that, Christians were treated slightly better. They were still persecuted. It was still illegal. But that century, between that time and before Constantine comes in, generally regarded to be one of the most peaceful and prosperous times. But it was a peace and prosperity that was expanding around a core of vapor. The Roman Empire was thinning out, and it was becoming very much like what people accuse the American Republic of being, but the British Empire is a better example of that, where you're trying to take over the world and thinning out your resources as a result. Now, the most formidable challenge that the first apologists faced was how to show the superiority of their view over more full philosophies, like Stoicism and Epicureanism and Cynicism and Skepticism and Neoplatonism and Manichaeanism, which Augustine will eventually tackle both of those views because he comes out of them. But one guy you would be helpful to look at from a Neoplatonist perspective is a guy named Plotinus. Because there's a garden variety Neoplatonism that Gnosticism emerges from, and it really starts to give Plato even a bad name. But really, Plotinus's Neoplatonism, for all that's wrong with it, is actually a little bit more sophisticated. And I think there's reasons to, I don't really care about Plotinus or Neoplatonism, I'm not an apologist for them, but I think there's something in here, and maybe you'll see afterwards, that is worth looking at. Plotinus' dates were 205 to 270. I'd probably say he was the best philosophical pagan mind since Aristotle, and until the Enlightenment. I mean, if you think about it. So, he's worth mentioning for that reason alone. But he gave the Neoplatonists their seminal work, the Aeneids. He talked about an ultimate being that he simply called the One. I'll make it glow, because so you know what we're talking about here. Now, this One was beyond both being and mind. In other words, the ultimate person of sorts, certainly he's a mind, defies all categories of metaphysics or epistemology, except, of course, all the ones assumed in any sentence used to say such mystical things, because he's assuming a lot of things that are true about this thing in order to say that. Now, since other things do exist aside from this One, there needs to be an explanation for how they came to be and what their purpose is or their destiny, if they have any. Plotinus referred to all other secondary causes as emanations flowing from the One without compromising the purity of the One. Now, one of the things he will take from Aristotle is that the contemplation of this being caused all other things to be in what he called emanations. Why does he have to resort to that? Because this being cannot be in the process of becoming. He cannot be changing. And therefore, in this static view of transcendence. He can't actually touch anything outside of himself. Okay? So other things simply have to emanate. And you say, well, was it an accident? Because then it would cause, and that's a lot of what Plato and Aristotle's problems were. They couldn't explain, ultimately, the first cause. Even though they did show and demonstrate that there must be a first cause, they couldn't explain secondary causes. The best of things in this order of these secondary causes is going to want to return to that one. And this reconciliation of all things to this one is utterly intellectual. If the best thing is intellectual and the best thing about man is the soul, that's one thing that he very strongly takes from Plato. The ultimate being, the ultimate realm is invisible, eternal, unchanging, invisible, and so the superior soul, the superior part of man is likewise invincible. Invisible, it's immortal, it's unchanging, and so the best thing you could do, the design of your soul, is to point it through its proper faculty, namely the intellect, toward this ultimate intellectual being. Now, in Plotinus, we see a more sophisticated Neoplatonism than would be the case with the wandering Gnostic teachers. Matter was evil in itself, which is not the same thing as saying that matter is evil in itself. Let me distinguish those for you. If you ask a Gnostic, they would say that matter, that's just evil on the face of it. That's what they mean by in itself. It's evil through and through. Oh, is it matter? Yeah, it's evil. Okay, that's what they mean by that. But for Plotinus, he was following Plato with this distinction between being and becoming, or deprivation of being. So if you ask a Neoplatonist of the highest order, are you real, and is that a good thing, they would say, yes, insofar as I exist. But I'm becoming, I'm deteriorating, I'm corrupting. Like light going out and diffusing when you flip the switch back to darkness. Okay? So darkness has no being, but the diffusing light does have a participatory being. It's participating in being and being deprived of being at the same time. And so when he said matter in itself is evil, what he meant was matter if left to itself. Or as it is deprived of being, or falling, that it is good. How it is falling away from good. Okay, so there's being and becoming, or deprivation of being. So, yeah, what is this about the world soul? I don't care about that, I'm going to skip that. But as far as how does this have to do with man? Again, the soul, falling, but he can point himself back that way. By the way, you're going to notice that intellect is the problem, and when it's the problem, meaning sin is not the issue. And you see that with Plato, too. The idea of sin seems to be, though they understand that there's something wrong with man, and there's this tragedy to human society, the idea that sin is in any way primal with the problem in the intellect, that's not an issue for them. That's one of their big blind spots. So, in the same way that this soul of the world excels the stuff of the world, the intellect excels the body. In other words, this is a perfect blend of Plato and Aristotle here. From Plato, Plotinus takes the idea that being is good and the deprivation of being is evil. From Aristotle, he takes the fact that there is no matter without form. In other words, there's not just stuff unless it's in some shape, unless something is unchangeably true about it. So there's no matter without form, but prime matter, or matter if left to itself, matter in a state of pure potentiality, uninformed by intelligent process, would never exist. And so there has to be some intelligent design animating things down here. So he really takes the meat of Plato and Aristotle and spits out the bones. Now, so what he means is to the degree that matter was unintelligently driven, without soul, without intellect, to that degree it was evil. So if the world could still be regarded good in Neoplatonism, bodies and all, so long as intellect served as the direction toward heaven, and the deprivation of mind pointed in the opposite direction. In other words, just as Christians of a later era would be pressed to show that the Christian faith reconciled its truth to Aristotle's thought in a superior way to the Muslims were doing later on in the Middle Ages, so in this primitive era of the church, there was an initial battle of the superior philosophy. This was the best philosophy the pagans had. And so Christians wanted to show how the best of what they were saying was fulfilled only in biblical truth. So which view accounts for more of what we know to be true as the best of philosophy, the best of logic, just as you would the best of science or the best of history? Which view conforms to the facts or explains those facts the best? Let me just run through a couple of these apologists before we, whether or not we get to Ebionism, I don't know. But there's a couple of guys that are worth mentioning. This guy, Aristides of Athens, his dates are 100 to 134. Now, these guys are all minor players with the exception of Justin Martyr. But I'm running through them just to show you the common ground, what they're all doing and thinking. He presents, Aristides does, his apology, his defense to the Emperor Hadrian, so before Marcus Aurelius, sometime in the decade of the 120s. And it pretty much flows in that classical mode from philosophical foundations to comparative religion, showing the insufficiency of the Greek gods and the Roman gods by that time. Then he moves to the ethical superiority of the Christian ideal. It was widely read by Christian thinkers down through the beginning of the Middle Ages at least. There's a slightly older thinker named Quadratus that pretty much did the same thing. He also sent a defense to the same Hadrian, but only a small portion survived into the modern world, so it's of little value. Justin Martyr, he's the one that I find the most interesting, and most church historians do. Justin Martyr's dates are 103 to 165, or 168, depending on who you believe. Different church histories say the same thing, what year his martyrdom was. But the beginning of the second century to the middle of it. He was born in Samaria, so he was one of the fruits of Philip's evangelistic efforts there. But after growing up there, he went to study virtually every philosophy under the sun in Ephesus. And then finally, he moved to Rome sometime before 160. And he would be the resident Christian philosopher for the church there for the decade leading up to his martyrdom. His concise definition of Christianity was, quote, following God and the teaching derived from him. So, a path and a principle of truth. Following God and the teaching derived from him. In other words, Justin would not go for these pithy modern leaflet descriptions of the faith. Relationships, not rule. Belong, then believe. It's a person, not a path. Deeds, not creeds, and so on. His writings include the first apology to Antoninus Pius. Love those names. Pius, or the great, or man, they didn't have any friends to tell him, like those guys that show us American Idol, you know? So it's just, and then he wrote a second apology to the Roman Senate, a discourse to the Greeks, a treatise on the sovereignty of God, a treatise on the soul, and a dialogue with Trypho the Jew. Now, fragments of a book that he wrote, Refutation of All Heresies, are limited. At first you're thinking, Refutation of All Heresies, that's an ambitious project. Well, at that time, there was only a handful of them, so not so much. Refutation of All Heresies, that limited fragments come down to us. And there's another book he wrote on the resurrection, but a lot of people dispute that as being his. And against Marcion, he was one of many people that recognized that as one of the most damaging heresies. We'll get to that later. But here's the idea that's unique to Justin. It was his unfolding of the Greek concept of the Logos, the Word. And you remember John uses that Greek word in his Gospel prologue. And so he's just taking that seriously. So in chapter 1, verse 1, the Word was God, the Logos was God. And that Logos, in verse 9, enlightens everyone. You ever notice that? That life was the light of men, which enlightens everyone. And that is prior to the incarnation, John says in verse 10. He was in the world. So he made the world, and he was in the world prior to the incarnation, in some other way, as this Logos. Now, this could be accused, as some historian and commentators do, of paralleling the Stoic doctrine of the seminal word. So the Stoics would talk about the Logos as what they called a divine spark in every single person. I'm going to make that glow too, just to show the point. Yeah. The divine spark. But that Logos was the rational ordering principle that moved everything in this world. And the main thing that it moved, because it was the main thing that conformed to its image, was a man. A thinking thing. So is Justin just borrowing this? Well, Justin's whole point is that the Greeks were dependent on general revelation. So Justin would say that I'm borrowing it, and they borrowed it. In other words, just as the law pointed the Jew forward to Christ, so the Logos pointed the Gentile forward to Christ. Christ was the fulfillment, the incarnation of the rational ordering principle that is God. So, it is our task now as Christians to simply explain, through the lens of special revelation, what this general revelation, this logic is. Justin's language in defense of Jesus Christ floats between narrative and deduction, depending on who he's speaking to. If he's speaking to Jews, he deals with narrative. If he's speaking to Greeks, he deals with deductions and philosophy. But historians go too far in citing him as a deviation from the Trinitarian doctrine. He speaks in two places at least of Christ being, quote, distinct in number, though not in will. Now, there's two ways to read the meaning of these words, number and will. Both Trinitarians and non-Trinitarians will insist on a distinction in number. That's not anything different. Both Trinitarians and non-Trinitarians insist on a distinction of number. The former Trinitarians in the number of persons in one being. The latter in the number of beings. In other words, ask yourself if the church historian you're reading even understands the doctrine of the Trinity before you accept this garbage. Both do this. Trinitarians insist on a distinction in the number of persons in one being. Non-Trinitarians in the number of beings. Hence the word number simply begs the question. Likewise with the word will. The adherent to the Trinity will insist that the faculty of will is distinct between the persons, yet the direction of the will is always the same in God unified. Such quotes only prove something for people who have only looked at the doctrine on a very superficial level. Justin himself explains this, quote, and that this power, which the prophetic word calls God, as has been also amply demonstrated, he's talking about Christ in the Old Testament as an angel in some cases. Remember those angelophanies they're called, or theophanies? There's many cases. For example, the captain of the Lord's army that shows up to Joshua, the three people that show up to Abraham, the one that shows up to Gideon, the one that shows up to Hagar, they are referred to in one sense as angel of the Lord, and then the Lord said while they're still there. It's like, what? Well, who is it? Well, it's the Lord. That's what it's saying. The manifestation is an angel, an angelic manifestation. So he's saying, from this perspective, and this is when he's arguing to Jews about the Old Testament pointing to Christ, an angel, he is an angel, and is not numbered as different in name only, like the light of a sun, but is indeed something numerically distinct. I've discussed briefly in what has gone before. When I asserted that this power was begotten from the Father by his will and power, but not by abscission, as if the essence of the Father were divided, as all other things partitioned and divided are not the same after as before they were divided. So he's talking about this idea of begottenness long before the creeds talked about it, what it means. And for the sake of example, I took the case of fires kindled from a fire, which we see to be distinct from it, and yet that from which many can be kindled is by no means made less, but remains the same. So there you have an early description of this procession from and still being within the same being. So there's no change in Christ, but there is a procession of proceeding forward from the Father. So what Justin's doing here is to explain to these people that he is saying that this is one being, and they're distinct persons, and the second person is proceeding from eternally and unchangeably. Okay? So people that are familiar with the whole debate about the Trinity throughout the first couple centuries are going to immediately recognize that Justin's already anticipating this objection, and he's holding to the doctrine of the Trinity. Now, the most that we can say about Justin is that he often pressed this or that piece of imagery too far to stress the independence of the Logos from the Alexandrian school, which you're going to talk about in a little bit. I'm probably not going to get to Ebionism. So let me cut through the rest of some of these. I have a list of the apologists for you on your notes. People like Tatian, who's interesting because, in one, he provides a standard, a harmony of the Gospels called the Dia Tesseron, the Way of Four, for the early church. It was very widely used. But what's also interesting about him is that he jumped ship. After his mentor, Justin Martyr, is martyred, he goes east and starts to embrace a Gnostic heresy. And Eusebius talks about that and others. So that's a rare case of somebody who's acting as an apologist, but from the record looks like he's an apostate. Interesting stuff there. Athenagoras was a philosopher to the Athenians and to the Romans, and he writes an apology, also a plea to Marcus Aurelius for justice for the persecuted Christians. A guy named Theophilus of Antioch, same thing. He's a pastor doing apologetics at a very high level. There's other guys that are on that list. Julius Africanus is interesting because he's the one that famously refuted the claim of Thales made in about 165 or so. 65, so the century before. Okay, he's the one that refuted the claim that was made after the crucifixion that the vernal equinox was the real cause of the sun going dark in the daytime across the world. Now, Thales' work doesn't survive. But that excerpt is in the middle of the second century and would have been an embarrassment to Christians, remembering that the faith is still illegal for another 150 years. It would have been an embarrassment to Christians if either Thales or the quote was a fabrication. That could have been easily refuted. Melito of Sardis is interesting because he, in addition to being an apologist, compiles one of the earliest canons, the earliest one on record, dated around 150 usually. Now, that's just an Old Testament canon, I believe. I could be wrong. Could be a New Testament in there as well. But Melito of Sardis is interesting for that reason. Two guys that I'm probably just not going to get into, Clement of Alexandria and Origen. Basically, the Alexandrian school, apparently I've erased the map, but the Alexandrian school is very much known for its focus on gnosis or knowledge. Clement, not to be confused with Clement of Rome that Josh talked about earlier, Clement of Alexandria, his dates are 150 to 215, so I will write them really quickly, and I just won't get to Ebionism, that's fine. Clement and Origen of Alexandria. Clement was first, Origen second. And they were running a catechetical school of Alexandria, focusing obviously on a catechism, not on a cataclysm. Sorry. Which, you know, hopefully you know what that is. Basically, you're dealing with grammar and getting people to simply memorize important truths, drill it into their head. And so, this is really the first example that we see of that. Now, Clement talked about a gnosis for God's elect, but unlike the Gnostics, he meant what Paul meant by the mysterion that he talked about in Ephesians, something that's preached openly without any other initiation ceremony or anything like that, no smoke-filled rooms. It's open to anybody who will hear the truth and love it. His theology is sometimes called Christian Platonism, which I think is probably accurate. And basically, these guys synthesized Greek truth. Now, the question is, did they move from synthesis to something called syncretism? Clearly, you can see that with Origen. Syncretism just comes from the Greek words, or in this case, the Latin word credo, but in a sense, and with. So in a sense, I believe with you. In other words, there's a cultural bartering going on here. I'll give you this if you give me that in your worldview. You mix your worldview with something of another worldview that, as it turns out, doesn't really go together with that worldview. That's syncretism. And so these guys were very much, I think, guilty of that, particularly in Origen. For example, Origen believed in the preexistence of the soul and the salvation of every single person, even toying with the potential hope for the fallen angels. By the way, Origen's dates are 185 to 254, so right after Clement, 185 to 254. One thinker, by the way, Hans Küng in the 20th century, called Origen, quote, the only real genius among the Greek church fathers, among the Alexandrians. Okay? So he believes in the preexistence of the soul, the salvation for every single person. In his book on first principles, he basically teaches, and you can see the Gnostic ideas permeating his thinking, the body is basically a prison. It's a punishment for the soul that was previously existing in an eternal, invisible, contemplative state. Salvation then was achieved both mediately and immediately by knowledge of first things. His main defensive apologetic was contra Celsum in 248. So you remember Celsus. He's writing to refute him. Probably the only famous tract from the early period of Christian history that directly takes on figures outside of Christian circles. He writes a bunch of other things that I'm not going to get into right now, but here's the closing point I would make. We learn a lot about mission from the apologists of the first couple centuries, just as we did from the apostles. Philip Schaff, in his 19th century church history, notes that there are no famous missionaries to speak of from the first few centuries, and yet the Christian faith exploded exponentially and across the known world. He's not saying that missionaries are bad or that there wasn't really missionaries. Listen to his point. Quote, Christianity, once established, was its own best missionary. It grew naturally from within. It attracted people by its very presence. It was a light shining in darkness and illuminating that darkness. And while there was no professional missionaries devoting their whole life to this specific work, every congregation was a missionary society, and every Christian believer a missionary, inflamed by the love of Christ to convert his fellow men, end quote. So, in that church context, you trained thinkers who were then the best one-on-one evangelists. These were truth terrorist cells. The early church believed that you not only attacked the city, but you trained your people to be, every one of them, an apologetic missionary. Not a missionary who apologizes for being a missionary, but one who knows the Christian worldview so much and the superiority of it that you launch out people each week to exist where they exist, in the workplace, in their family, and conquering with the truth of the Christian worldview. So you have an army of people who can't be refuted, so that you have to kill them. The only thing you can do is either convert or kill. If Christians are not producing people that make people to the point of convert or kill, I either have to be converted to what you're saying or I have to kill you because you're ruining my fantasy. If you don't do that, you're not doing Christianity. That's Schaff's point. In this unprecedented expansion, we have a precedent that once was set causes us to look again at everywhere else in church history and see the same thing. Where Christians have viewed Christian truth as the kind of thing that owns the city, that owns conversations, the Christian faith spreads like wildfire, no exception. And conversely, the opposite. A famous missionary is nothing but a lowercase a apostle or pioneering evangelist. There's a place for them to blaze those trails and plant the flag where it's not been before. But ultimately, in general, every Christian is a missionary. When all truth is God's truth, if you want to get everybody on mission and talk about missiology and that every Christian is a missionary, you need worldview to do that. People will not be sufficiently motivated to go out in culture if they don't believe they're spreading anything except a mirror for the wonderfulness of that culture and your own false humility that you dare not be an imperialist and spread your truth like it's a virus or a disease or something, that you're going to wipe out some indigenous population because of your arrogance. The only way you're going to sufficiently go to the mission field is if you believe the truth you have is superior. Unless everything else is viewed as banality when ultimate truth seizes the soul. You would always hear things like this, as Tertullian said in his apology. He's writing to the biggest head honchos in Rome. He's saying, we are but of yesterday, and yet we already fill your cities, islands, camps, your palace, senate, and forum. We have left you only to your temples. In other words, we are destroying you. We are scorched earth. You know, we are just scorching the earth with truth. You're killing us, and you'll continue to do so. But we're infecting. We've already infected. Your body is already diseased with the superior worldview. You only have one choice left: bow or burn. Any questions about the early apologists or anything about this forming of orthodoxy, which I'll get more into in the third and fourth session, which we will have on our site. Any questions at all? Do you feel as though I've imperialized you? Is this imperialistic? Look at these imperialists, by the way. They were illegal. They were underground. They didn't do this with missiles and stuff. You can't say that this kind of a stance only arises when people are in control. This is the sociological result of a bunch of people who are used to winning, the winning team. I don't think so. That doesn't work in the first three centuries. Okay, so you have to relearn a lot of what you've caught from the airborne viruses of evangelical books on virtually every subject in the last 20 years. And from liberal theologians who said the same stuff in the 19th century. But if we don't know our history, we won't know that all the stuff being said in the conservative church now is exactly and totally what the 19th century German higher critics and other liberal following Hegel and Kant said in the 19th century. Yep.
Well, it's important that Christian evangelism, the rejection of the church is lumped in with actual imperialism. I mean, shouldn't we draw a line between advancing things through bloodshed and building military bases and actually bringing the Christian...
You could, but then you'd be drawing a line, and I feel oppressed. Uh-huh. See, you're drawing lines in the sand. That's the problem with you guys.
Yeah. Well, actually, Spurgeon wrote some pretty neat stuff about how he had changed his views coming from England and seeing this advancement through bloodshed and warfare. He said,
right.
This we've erred here. And if this is our push to spread Christianity, we're wrong.
Stick a microphone in the face of anybody that's extending Christendom with a machine gun and ask them what they believe about the faith. And I dare you to find somebody that actually believes in the faith who you stick that microphone. This is a secular viewpoint. The Inquisitions were a secular movement by people that didn't believe anything anymore. And they were persecuting people for opening their Bibles. So, show me an imperialist and I will show you a heretic with a machine gun. Word.
Josh answered that question really well, actually, about Gnostic, but I just thought maybe you wanted to talk a little bit about that being a root, because everything you've been talking about, there's this root of Gnostic. I just kind of got my eye raised to it this last few weeks, and looking at, is that somewhere we can really take and say this is a battle front where it will help us take on some of the other heresies. Gnostic views just seem to permeate everything.
Gnosticism, we tend to only look at it, there's two strands of Gnosticism, but actually they're connected to each other. One is we sort of mean an epistemological Gnosticism, and that's the secret knowledge thing. But then there's also this metaphysical Gnosticism. Basically, I'll give you the nutshell since you're not going to be here for that particular one. The Gnostics believed that they start with Neoplatonism. This one is the ultimate, what they called eons. These angelic beings or lights were paired up and through, I won't call it celestial sex, but we'll just call it celestial sex. And the next eon that came as a result of it was then also this light bearer, and there was this sphere that they called the pleroma, the Greek word fullness. And at the bottom end was this kenoma, or emptiness. So you see the Platonism here, being, deprivation of being. And at the very tail end of it, there were 30 of these eons at all. Now, along this line, there was Sophia that stepped out of her place and tried to behold. See, originally, nobody except for these two, I think Nous and somebody else who was a good thinker, beheld the father figure perfectly. And for everybody else, it was shrouded in mystery. It was ineffable, incomprehensible light. But Sophia stepped out of her bounds. They pick on women, these guys. Don't be a Gnostic. Because Sophia stepped out of her bounds. Okay? That word is the Greek word for wisdom, except she was a little too wise in her own eyes and so on, and so she stepped out of her bounds. Now, in order to subvert this, trying to look at God, pull the veil away, the next group of eons gave birth to two more, the Son and the Holy Spirit figures. And so the Son agrees to redeem, agrees to, Spirit Brother Lucifer, where have I heard that after? Oh, Mormonism. Yeah, that's right. So after that, the Son redeems because he agrees with the plan to redeem humanity, which redemption is intellectual. He just shares. So he takes flesh, which is normally bad, but he does so to liberate people from the prison of their bodies. What am I forgetting here? It doesn't matter. The whole thing's jacked up. You can pretty much see.
God, the demiurge.
Demiurge, that's what I'm missing. Demiurgos in the Greek is craftsman. And so one of these guys, Plato's Timaeus, it was his creation myth, so to speak. The reason there's a demiurgos is because a craftsman has to borrow from the forms, this Greek word, where we get the word idea. And so these forms were the blueprint. Now in the Christian worldview, the Father sees the Word, the Logos, and He sees His own reflection. He creates as the result of things about Himself. He does not look outside of Himself for some blueprint that He depends upon. Now this demiurgos was a bad guy, because he is responsible for this world of darkness and matter. It was matter and chaos. Okay? So the real God would never have created this world that contains evil that you see today. So the Gnostics would look at the Old Testament and they would typically do one of two things. Valentinus in Rome and other of the main Gnostic teachers would say that the Old Testament's real, but it's real revelation from God, it's good, but you have to be able to get to the sense of it, and only us really smart people, the pneumatics, from the word pneumatikos, which comes from the word for spirit, pneuma. The pneumatikos, we understand it, and you somatics, you people of the body, you're just the knuckle draggers that when you look at the Bible, you just think there's a bunch of these myths and you believe that they're historical facts and so on. You don't realize it's all allegory. Teaching some higher spiritual truth that you have to have the secret Klingon decoder ring to get into. So it wasn't like they were saying higher truth will teach it to you, because all truth is, you know, as long as you love it. They were saying you have to be part of the initiate, the pneumatikos. Okay? And so they unveiled this now Marcion, started from the same place, but Marcion said, I don't even make sure the Old Testament is real scripture, but you guys allegorizing it? No, it means what it says, which is why it's so evil. Yahweh in the Old Testament is a brutal dictator. The God of love, Jesus, is nothing like that in the New Testament. Where have I heard this? Oh, yeah, exactly. 19th century liberalism, and then it spreads everywhere else. And so you separate the Old Testament God, who's not, he is the demiurgos. This devil god that created the physical matter. Jesus parachutes in disguise, and then so you get Docetism. Notice that Marcionism and Docetism are species of Gnosticism. Docetism is the Gnostic doctrine of Christ. Marcionism is the Gnostic doctrine of Scripture. Okay, so Marcion starts to divide up the canon, getting rid of all the Old Testament and anything in the New Testament that's not Paul. Paul's the only one that can correctly interpret Jesus, because Paul was very negative toward the Jewish Old Testament. No, he wasn't. But he was very negative to it. So I only accept Luke's gospel, but I'm going to throw anything out that makes Jesus talk about hell and dirt. Okay? Anything that talks about bodies and stuff like that, that's out of there. So not even Paul was always Pauline enough for Marcion. And so church historians talk about how sophisticated Marcion was. How he went through there with a scalpel like a good scholar and started taking things out he didn't like Thomas Jefferson. Because Thomas Jefferson's the best biblical scholar ever. That's what they say. That's Gnosticism in a nutshell, and it's alive and well in the church today.
And
all the Greek words.
He isn't even given a pass, because he actually thought he was the only God. And
yeah.
So he didn't know, he's just been let loose.
Yeah.
He was creating these things with inherent failing.
And of course, the heresy of Gnosticism is not called Gnosticism.
No, now it's just called
a more sophisticated
it's not more sophisticated. But any suspicion of anything down here, the suspicion of the mind to reduce the mind, the modern version of the trichotomous position in charismatic Pentecostal circles is direct Gnostic teaching. The submerging the mind down into the realm of the flesh and calling that devilish is a Gnostic idea. So different Christian groups are Gnostic about different things. So take the soul, take the mind, the affections, and the will. Different... Maw? What? So the parts of the soul... You know, you got the experiential circles like the Charismatics and the Quakers, and so they are Gnostic about the mind. Come on, right before you talk. You have a lot of high church, they're up here because they're high church, they're above everybody else. So, for example, Anglicans, Presbyterians, and too often the Reformed, who are suspicious of the affections. And Jonathan Edwards had to put the smack down on them with his book, The Religious Affections. And then there are those who are Gnostic about the will, a lot of non-denominational groups, that anything, any amount of excellence and planning and anything like that is, oh, it's horrible. So different Christians are suspicious about different parts of the soul that God made good, and they're still good as to their essence. They're corrupted by the fall, but thinking, feeling, and doing are not the problem, per se. So the evangelical movement is largely Gnostic. There are a lot of other things, but they're very Gnostic, and it's just a partial Gnosticism. So it's okay.
But then intellectuals can get called, or people who are concerned with intellectual apprehension can get called Gnostic.
If they're esoteric about it, if they're subjectivist. But notice that if somebody says, I have a truth that's so important that I can't communicate it to you. Okay, that's not truth anymore. That's a burning in my bosom. I'm just using the words reason, intellect, stuff like that. Yeah. Ex cathedra speeches from the Pope, that's relativism. That's relativism. Joseph Smith under the tree, Pope in the balcony, both relativism. Majority vote, relativism. Denominational heads voting on what's true, if they can get them off the golf course once every 5 years, relativism.
They're the very thing they're trying to say that that's not.
Yeah, we're going to protect orthodoxy by being as old and as playing as much golf as we can. And shuffleboard. And we'll vote them. We've got the confession if you can pay for it. That's relativism. Relativism. So that's an esoteric appeal to my mommy had more money than you. We had this apostolic succession. Joseph Smith, really a lot of burning in the bosom going on. That is an appeal to a truth that you can't. Now we can't talk about that. Muslims' view of their scriptures that it has to be understood in the original Arabic, and only the original Arabic that I know and you can't right now.
But it's shrouded. I mean, the way that they say that though is that it's a holy language.
Yeah,
they're saying essentially the same thing, but the holy language, and we wouldn't defile the truth in your language.
Right.
You must learn this in order.
Right.
I can't even speak the words because it doesn't.
Starting now, and then you have to mime it, and at that point, then it's a holy mime. But if you holy mime and you do that right, then you have to move a step back and say, "What about that's whatever that was," and it's an infinite regress of meaningless statements. Yeah, holy mime. I'm going with it.